Good afternoon, Juno. It's 2:59 p.m. It's time for another edition of the Juno Afternoon. I'm Ken Fix. I will be your host for today. And on the show, we'll be talking with Karen Fortwängler about Saturday's Helping Hands Dinner and Auction. We'll also hear about another Saturday event, a fundraiser for the Dolly Parton Imagination Library with Denise Hodnett. We'll learn about this week's Alaska Design Forum presentation on 3D printing. And the new Juno School Superintendent, Mark Miller, will be here to introduce himself and highlight next week's first day of school. A lot of people looking forward to that. These guests, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more for Tuesday, August 19th, 2014. Stay tuned. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Wyoming's primary election is taking place today. This year, eight people from the two tribes on the Wind River Reservation are running for state and county office in multiple parties. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
Wyoming Democratic Representative Patrick Goggle says it's anything but politics as usual on the Wind River Reservation.
I would say that's probably the largest number of Natives that I've seen file in a primary election.
And it's his theory that the political gusto is due to the shifting dynamic in the Republican Party. He says the politicizing of the right wing is happening everywhere, including Wind River.
The Tea Party movement in Wyoming has created what I would say political opportunities for those that have extreme right-wing views.
So are you saying that some of the tribal members are falling into some of those categories?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Constitutionalists, libertarians, Democrats, tribal members are campaigning under many banners and often against each other. For instance, Goggle's niece, Northern Arapaho Andrea Clifford, is running for his open spot against two other tribal members, one Democrat, one Republican. But Clifford says she thinks that a lot of choices on a ballot are good for voters.
I want our constituents to learn, and I think it would force them to say, hey, I got a choice here, so let me inform myself about both of the candidates.
Sergio Maldonado is in a race for state senate with two other tribal members, one from each party. He says it's complex issues like Medicaid expansion and water rights that's attracting candidates. He says that's why it's more important than ever to have tribal members in office.
It's not about being invited to the table. It's about being on the agenda at the table.
Maldonado says he hopes the larger number of tribal names on the ballot will translate to a robust voter turnout for the primary election. I'm Melody Edwards.
Northwest tribal leaders representing the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission are applauding a decision to reject an energy permit application. It involves a proposed coal export project along the river. Will Robbins has more.
Yesterday's decision by the Oregon Department of State Lands is a significant setback to Amber Energy's proposal and was made partly on evidence of federally protected treaty fishing activities that occur in a stretch of the Columbia River where tribal fishing takes place. Chairman of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission, Carlos Smith, said the landmark decision reflects what is in the best interest of the region, not just a company's pocketbook.
The coal that's being shipped down the river is not good for anyone, including the salmon recovery that we're working on. So there's a great victory to hear the state understand what the tribes are telling them and back up the tribes.
The Tribal Treaty Fishing Right guarantees tribal members the right to fish at all usual and accustomed fishing areas. These rights were secured in treaties signed with the United States government in 1855. The proposed Morro Pacific Coal Terminal has been opposed by tribal leaders, local communities, and members of the general public since it was proposed. In Oregon, I'm Will Robbins for National Native News.
The proposed project would bring coal from the Rockies to be shipped down the Columbia River and then sent to overseas markets. The company is exploring its legal options. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell and Assistant Secretary for Indian Affairs Kevin Washburn will tour school on the Leech Lake Reservation in Minnesota today to look at construction needs. They'll also meet with school officials, teachers, and students to discuss challenges. The Leech Lake School was originally built to house an auto mechanic school and bus garage. The facility is now a K-12 school, which serves nearly 200 students. It has multiple safety and security concerns. On Monday, Jewell and Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan toured an Indian school in Maine. A study group was formed last year to assess Bureau of Indian Education schools and propose a reform plan. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And before we get going today, I should apologize because tomorrow is the first day of school, not next week. So bad news for some and good news for others. My first guest is Karen Fortwängler here in the studio, and she's going to be telling us about this Saturday's Helping Hands Dinner and Auction. I'd like to welcome her in here. Hi, Karen. How are you?
Hi. Thank you. I'm doing good.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the Helping Hands Dinner.
Okay. Well, Helping Hands is basically a nonprofit organization, and we pick up food from the stores that's outdated 4 times a week, and we pass it out at our warehouse. The warehouse, all the people that do this are volunteers. So any rent that we have to pay for our space, any electricity we have to pay for our space, all comes through fundraising. And that's why we hold this annual dinner and auction. It's a live and silent auction, and that's why we hold it in August to help us so that we can pay the bills that we need to pay. In fact, oil for heating the place in the wintertime, keeping our refrigerators and freezers running. But we've got that coming up this Saturday, the 23rd, at Valley Chapel. That's just off the back loop road. And dinner starts at 5. And my mom usually puts on a really good dinner. She's the director of Helping Hands. And she makes a big spread, enough for hundreds of people. The tickets are $10, and you can get them at the door. And our live auction starts at 6 o'clock. So I'd like to talk about some of the items. Juno businesses really do come through for us. I'd like to mention some of them. Bullwinkles donated 2 big Super Bowl pizzas. Those are those $100 pizzas that they have. They donated those for our auction. Prince's Tours donated a lunch aboard one of the Prince's cruise lines for 4, including wine. And so I'm really excited about that. That's a big thing for people that go on. Orca Tours, they donated a whale watching trip for us. And Core Alaska donated some outer gear wear from Core Alaska, which is the first time they've ever donated to us. So I'm really grateful for that. And we have all kinds of certificates from other businesses in town, numerous and numerous certificates that we put on our silent and some on our live auction. Wings of Alaska has donated a trip to Taku Glacier, and also there's another trip that they donated, and it skipped my mind what that trip is, but Wings of Alaska donated another trip for us. And then Alaska Travel Ventures donated a river float trip, so if you ever want to go on a river float trip, you can come get that trip from us at the auction. Oh, and North Star Trekking donated a walkabout on the glacier. So we've got really a wide variety of auction items, from really kind of inexpensive things to the more high up things that we hope that will bring us a lot of money. Our main goal is to really get people out there to this auction, because the auction really helps us raise the money that we need that will get us through, we hope, winter time. We do other fundraisers throughout the year. We'll do the Halloween carnival again at the mall. The kids love that. And in the summertime, you know, we're down near at Sandy Beach, flipping burgers, selling burgers, you know, for the 4th of July. So this is our purpose. We're here to help people with their food needs as much as we can. Our warehouse is open twice a week. We're opening tonight. But it's important that people understand that this is how we are able to survive. We pay our bills by doing these fundraisers. And that's why it's really important that we have as many people as we can get out to this auction at the church.
Karen, this all benefits Catholic Charities, does it not?
Catholic Charities?
Yes.
No, this is for Helping Hands.
Oh, this is all for Helping Hands.
Yes.
Okay. All right, and how many years has the event been running?
This event, I checked with the director, which is my mom, Betty Kapler, and she was trying to crush the years back, but she thinks this auction has been going on for about the last 8 years, she believes. Helping Hands has been in town when we first moved up here in 84. It wasn't called Helping Hands. It just, my mom found a need when she noticed somebody was diving in the dumpster for food to survive on food. So she found a need. She talked to the stores in town in about 84 when we first moved up here. And it started from her small garage, and we've slowly built up to where we're at now on Schweitzer Creek. But Helping Hands started becoming a nonprofit organization in the early 90s.
Karen, when is the auction going to be, and where is this going to be?
Okay.
Auction and the dinner are the same place, I would guess.
Yeah, you got that right. So again, it's at Valley Chapel on the Mendenhall Loop, Back Loop Road, which is right across from Montana Creek Road there. And the dinner starts at 5 on Saturday, and the auction starts at 6 o'clock. That's the live auction. Now, the silent auction will start right at 5, and we usually end the silent auction around 7, so people can get their stuff and stick around or not stick around. It's up to them.
All right. Is there a website that you have where people can go for more information?
There's not, but if anybody has any information, I would be happy they can call me. And my number is 957-6632. And again, it's for Karen, and my number is 957-6632. And we will have plenty of tickets at the door. If you don't have your ticket yet, that's fine. We'll have plenty of tickets at the door.
All right, Karen Fort Wang with Helping Hands, thank you very much for being our first guest on the show today.
All right, well, thank you for having me. So I hope to see everybody out there.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday, the 19th of August, 2014. It's the birthday of the novelist Jonathan Coe, born in Lickey, a suburb of Birmingham, 1961, author of The Accidental Woman. It was on this date, 1829, the French painter and physicist Louis Daguerre presented his photographic process to the French Academy of Sciences. The first actual photograph had been made a couple of years earlier by Joseph Nicéphore Niépce, but the quality wasn't very good. The plate had to be exposed for 8 hours to capture an image, and Daguerre found a better way. He found that if he coated a copper plate with silver iodide, exposed it to light for 20 to 30 minutes, fumed it with mercury vapor, fixed it with a salt solution, he could get a permanent image. He called it a daguerreotype, of course, after himself. Many early photographers died from mercury poisoning using this method, but it was the method that was used. People lined up to have their portraits taken, though they knew you had to sit in blazing sunlight for up to half an hour, trying not to blink, your head clamped in place to keep it still, which is why they had such grim facial expressions. But it was a marvelous, mystifying, even scarifying thing at the time to look at an image of your actual self. It's the birthday of Ogden Nash, born Rye, New York, 1902, wrote 20 volumes of humorous verse and two musicals, One Touch of Venus and Two's Company. Ogden Nash, who said, "Middle age is when you're sitting at home on a Saturday night and the telephone rings and you hope it isn't for you." It's the birthday of Philo Farnsworth, the inventor of the television, born in a log cabin, Beaver, Utah, 1906. He was 21 years old in 1927 when he transmitted his first image by television. It was a straight line. And it's the birthday of Gene Roddenberry, El Paso, Texas, 1921, the father of Star Trek. He flew B-17 bombers during World War II, was an officer in the LAPD, started writing for television, and in 1964, he developed the idea of a new series about space exploration. Desilu Productions took it up. It came out in 1966. Ratings were never great, only went on for three seasons, but it was a huge success in syndication and spawned 11 feature films. Here's a poem for today by Mary Oliver, The Country of the Trees. There is no king in their country, and there is no queen, and there are no princes vying for power, inventing corruption. Just as with us, many children are born, and some will live and some will die, and the country will continue. The weather will always be important. And there will always be room for the weak, the violets, and the bloodroot. When it is cold, they will be given blankets of leaves. When it is hot, they will be given shade. And not out of guilt, neither for a year-end deduction, but maybe for the cheer of their colors, their small flower faces. They are not like us. Some will perish to become houses or barns, fences and bridges. Others will endure past the counting of years, and none will ever speak a single word of complaint, as though language, after all, did not work well enough, was only an early stage. Neither do they ever have any questions to the gods, which one is the real one, and what is the plan, as though they have been told everything already and are content. The Country of the Trees by Mary Oliver from her collection Blue Horses, published by Penguin and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
As a reminder, during whale watch season, NOAA fisheries ask you to keep your distance from endangered humpback whales. Federal law prohibits pursuit or approach within 100 yards. Boaters should operate at a slow, safe speed, limit time with whales to 30 minutes or less, and avoid approaching when other vessels are near. To report a violation or distressed marine mammal, call NOAA fisheries hotline at 1-800-853-1964.
It's almost 3:18 p.m. You're listening to KTOO in Juneau. Juneau Afternoon is continuing. I'm Ken Fix. I'm your host. And my next guest is Denise Hodnett, and she's going to be talking about Saturday's fundraiser for the Dolly Parton Imagination Library. Hi, Denise. How are you today?
Good afternoon. I'm great. Thank you.
Okay, it's good having you here. All right, let's talk about the event that's coming up this Saturday.
Well, the event that we're going to be having on Saturday is a combination with the Juneau Imagination Library and the Juneau Emblem Club's state president will be here for her visitation. And her special project this year is the Imagination Library. So we're going to have her out there along with Joy Lyon with the Imagination Library in Juneau to offer baked goods and just information about how to sign your children up for the Imagination Library and what the program is all about.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about that. What is the Imagination Library?
Well, in 1995, Dolly Parton decided that she wanted to help with literacy in her hometown area, which is in East Tennessee. So she decided to start this Imagination Library and provide books to children throughout that area. And it caught on so big that in the year 2000, the program was sent throughout the United States, Canada, and the United Kingdom for people, other communities, if they wanted to participate. She would also help them with donations to the children. And this is, if you sign your child up for the Imagination Library from birth to 5 years old, they receive an appropriate book for their age up till they're 5 years old. Every month they receive a book. And with the Emblem Club does participates by sponsoring books to the Imagination Library. And our current president, Judy Blankenship, this year, her special project is Imagination Library Alaska. So any money that she raises this year is going to go to Imagination Library in the state of Alaska.
All right, and this says that, you can register them and receive a free book every month. So that's like 48 books.
Yeah, and I actually talked to a coworker who I did not know until today that her children were signed up with Imagination Library, and she told me that she just thought it was wonderful, and the kids did receive very nice books. And I know that the books that I have seen are really good, and it's exciting for kids to get their own mail and see, you know, reading material. It's also been proven that the literacy rate has improved with children that have been enrolled in this program. And just so that you know, there is over 750,000 children signed up with Imagination Library, and there is over 1,600 communities that are doing this program throughout the United States.
And let's talk about the baked goods that we may be having show up here for this event. I always like to hear about the baked stuff and the raffle tickets. So let's talk about that.
Yeah, the Juno Emblem Club is sponsoring this event, and on Saturday, August 23rd, from 11 to 2 p.m. at the Minden Hall Mall, they will be there selling baked goods and raffle tickets for the Imagination Library, and all the money raised will be donated to the Imagination Library on behalf of the Alaska State Emblem Club President, Judy Blankenship. And baked goods, all kinds of things, cookies, probably some pies and cakes. I'm not sure what all the members will be bringing, but I'm sure there will be lots out there. And we would like to see as many people as we can come out and get their children signed up for the Imagination Library.
Of course. And remind everybody again, date and time, it's this Saturday, and it's from 11 to 2, right?
Correct. 11 to 2 at the Minden Hall Mall, across from the Minden Hall Library. So we'll be out there. And I think Joy Lyon from the Imagination Library, Juno, will also be there on hand to talk about the Imagination Library.
Very good. Well, Denise, thank you very much for being our guest on the show today. It wasn't that hard, was it? It's just the first time on the radio here, so.
It wasn't that bad. I really appreciate the invitation, and thank you very much.
Thank you for being our guest. And now we're going to hear a little bit of Elvis Costello. It's called Every Day I Write the Book, while we're waiting for our presentation on 3D printing.
When you find strange hands.
That was Elvis Costello with Every Day I Write the Book, and that was for the upcoming event for the Mendenhall Library. That's the Emblem Club, and that's going to be this Saturday, the 23rd, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. My next guests in the studio are Jesse Lewis Rosenberg and Jessica Rosenkrantz. They are the design team called Nervous System, and they're going to be talking about 3D printing. So I'm actually really excited to have them on the show because I need to learn about this one. What exactly is a 3D printer?
Well, a 3D printer is a machine that kind of works like a printer, except in 3D. So it builds up a solid shape in layers additively, and each layer kind of works like a regular printer. It'll trace down a drawing in some material. It can, there are printers that can print in all different types of materials. A lot of ones that people are familiar with print in plastic. So you lay down one layer of plastic and then put a layer on top of that and build up a shape layer by layer until it is fully formed.
Okay, does this machine do all that by itself, or do you actually have to have input in there as far as, you know, how does it scan whatever is in the machine?
Well, typically you create a design in some piece of software, like a computer-aided design software. You can also make things for printing by 3D scanning a real object, or you can find designs that other people have made online to download and make for yourself.
Okay, and why would people want to make a 3D printing of an object?
Well, isn't that kind of like why you'd want to make anything?
Well, I suppose, but I mean, if you've already got one, why would you want to duplicate a bunch of them?
And so a 3D printer isn't exactly like a copy machine. It's more just like any type of manufacturing equipment. So let's say like mold making, people can make thousands of identical parts by investing in some sort of tooling or mold that you can reuse. But with 3D printing, you can manufacture any shape, and you're not invested in any particular form. So you can make products that are sort of all one of a kind. And it's a way to make very precise objects sort of quickly and easily without any care about sort of the complexity of the design or investment in one specific form.
All right, Jessica, so it isn't like necessarily mass producing an item, like say I wanted to make like 10,000 Hot Wheels cars. This is, you know, a lot of this, is this geared towards industries that want to make like just a few copies of a specific item?
It's sort of like not particularly geared towards any industries right now, which is really what's interesting, is it's quite new. The technology was invented 30 years ago, but it's just becoming popularized now. But it's used a lot in industries that specialize in customization. So people are making prosthetics that are 3D printed, so made from a 3D scan of your body for you. People are making custom wedding bands and jewelry pieces that are 3D printed, something you just want one of. But then people are also doing things like miniature mass production, where maybe you don't need 10 million of them made in China, but you just want to make 1,000 of them locally, and you could use 3D printing to do that.
Okay, and what medium does it usually work in? Like you did mention plastic as probably one of the most popular and versatile ones. Can you use other materials to make 3D objects or not?
Well, it's sort of ever expanding the variety of things that you can create with 3D printers as people invent new technology, but right now, you can print anything from metal like stainless steel and titanium, ceramic, to more crazy out there things like food, chocolate, sugar, and you can do prints that are in full color, so kind of like a regular inkjet printing, but in 3D. And there's a whole spectrum of materials that you can print.
Okay, so does this have applications, like say I wanted to make like an aircraft part, and it could be made out of aluminum or some other kind of material, titanium. Is that being utilized in industry right now? Are they using those for that kind of limited production?
That is actually one of the specific uses that's very profitable
right now.
Well,
I just guessed on that one, but
there are parts in some of the newest Boeing airplanes that can only be made using metal 3D printing. So they've been optimized to be super lightweight but also strong. So they're essentially like cellular structures made of metal that you couldn't cast. They can only be made additively.
Okay. Do you know what specific parts they are?
I don't know what specific parts they are, so, yeah, unfortunately.
All right, and as far as what kind of time frame are we looking at in order to make a 3D construct using a 3D printer?
It really depends. I mean, sort of on a human time scale, it can be very slow. So on a desktop 3D printer, one that you could have in your home, it might take something like an hour to print something about an inch high, depending on the complexity of the object. And larger things, let's say something like a little bigger than a foot by a foot, might take more like 72 hours.
And what kind of input do you have as the operator in it? I mean, do you have to feed raw material into the machine, or how does that work?
It's pretty similar to working with an inkjet printer in your home. So you load a cartridge of material. That cartridge might be a spool of plastic filament, so essentially looks like thread, or it could be a liquid tank of plastic resin or a bed of stainless steel powder, and the machine just works off of that the entire time. You don't necessarily have to monitor it closely.
Most machines only work with one type of material. Some you can switch out for a couple different things, but sort of each material tends to be tied to a certain type of machine.
So if you had one that worked in plastic, you couldn't just suddenly put sheet metal in it and have it do the same thing?
Yeah.
All right, well, that makes sense. All right, and you're having the lecture and workshop that's coming up. Tell everybody when and where that's going to be.
So the lecture and workshop are tomorrow night. The lecture starts at 6, and then at 7 o'clock we take a break and then move into the workshop portion of it. The lecture will focus mostly on our work at our company, Nervous System, which combines science and art and technology together to design products. And then the workshop portion will focus entirely on 3D printing, talking about all the different technologies, and we'll have a machine there that you can see in person and get experience with how it operates. And I am not totally sure the name of the venue. I believe it is the Juno Arts and Culture Center, perhaps?
That would be right across the street from the studio here, the Jack. Yeah, that's right next door.
I got the name right.
Okay, so it's at the Jack tomorrow night. Okay, great. All right, anything else that you two wanted to add about 3D printing?
No, you can come to our workshop and find out a lot more information tomorrow night.
Okay, Jesse Louise Rosenberg and Jessica Rosenkrantz, thank you very much for being our guests on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
Child.
Support comes from Northern Audiology and Hearing Services, working with medical professionals to diagnose hearing disorders and prescribe solutions. Northland Audiology and Hearing Services. Information at 789-6780.
It's 3:39 p.m. Juno Afternoon continues with our last guest. I've been looking forward to talking to him all day. Here is Juno School Superintendent Dr. Mark Miller. He's going to be introducing himself to our listening audience and highlighting tomorrow's first day of school. Well, it's a great pleasure to have you here, Mark, and let's talk a little bit about you.
It would be my second favorite topic, but okay, sure.
Yeah, well, let's get this out of the way, and then we'll talk a little bit more about school. You have a background in biochemistry, so let's hear a little bit about that. So that's where you started.
It is where I started. I was pre-med and pre-dent at UC Davis for 4 years, and actually was accepted to dental school in UOP in San Francisco. And then right as I was going in, I said, you know, I don't think dentistry is for me. So then I was looking for a career. And they said, if you can teach chemistry, math, and physics, you will never go unemployed. We will absolutely guarantee you that for the rest of your life, you'll have a job somewhere if you can teach those subjects. And so I went back and got the credential and subbed while I was doing it so I could eat. And the first day in class, I'll never forget walking in and standing in the front of the class, and they said, oh, hi, Mr. Miller. And I'm like, my dad just came in? Where's my? I was looking around for my dad, and I realized I was Mr. Miller. And from that day on, I've been in love with education. I've been in love with teaching. I really just planned on doing it for a year or two because I figured I would have my summers off and I could figure out what I really wanted to do with my life. That was 30 years ago, and I've been in education ever since. I also had the opportunity when I was teaching science to do some internships in the summer with some fabulous places. Worked with Dow Chemical, inventing new compounds. Worked with Livermore Lab, working on laser coatings on mirrors. And it's just been given incredible opportunities by both the government and industry to hone my skills and do world-class research in between the teaching. That's how a biochemist ends up in education. And then after about a dozen years of doing that, I got my master's degree in administration and became a vice principal and a principal. And after I was a principal for a while, I moved into the district office and did HR work for a decade. And this is my first jump into the head chair as a superintendent.
Right, and what was your last position? Where were you just recently?
So my last position was Assistant Superintendent of Human Resources in Hayward, California, which is it's maybe 10 miles south of Oakland. So I grew up
in the Bay Area.
The San Francisco Bay Area. I grew up an Oakland A's fan, and both a Raiders and a 49ers fan. And so when we played the Seahawks, we're going to have some. Probably going to have to stay in my house by myself during that game because I know there's a pretty large Seahawk contingent up here.
There certainly is.
We'll have to work that out. But that was in Hayward, which had 21,000 students that we served and about 1,200 teachers. So this is much smaller, much more intimate, much friendlier place to be.
All right, and we had a few questions. Let's talk a little bit about enrollment. How many students do we have enrolled here for the fall?
As of yesterday, we had 4,837, which is actually over by about 50 students, 47 students more than we projected. So it's always good to have a few more students than you projected because we can bring on an extra teacher if we need to, but if you guess low, you're going to kill your budget because you just don't get enough money for the students that you're staffed for.
And are we adding a new teacher?
We are. Actually, we had to do a couple things. While we ended up with about the right number of students, a couple of the schools had less students than we thought, and a couple of the schools had more than we thought. So we had a couple positions that we hadn't filled that we were able to just not fill. And then we did add a teacher at our middle school just because we ended up with a few more students there.
All right. And I would like to talk to you a little bit about your approach to education and student success. What do you think factors into student success today more than anything else?
Boy, I don't think there is one thing that factors in. I think there's a multitude of things that factor in. One of the keys is support, the support that they get before school, the support that they get after school, their engagement. Do they want to be at school? Are they engaging with their peers, with their teachers, with the curriculum? Are they into it? Being able to process information is key. We've really changed the way education works. When I was in school, if you didn't know how to multiply, you were in trouble. Now,
oh, yeah, we couldn't even when I was in, we just couldn't just whip out a calculator and figure out the answer to something.
Right. Now you can whip out the 99-cent calculator and figure out the answer, but what you have to be able to do is look at that number and have an idea of whether it's right or wrong, because it's really easy to get a lot of information, and the calculator is just a classic example, right?
Well, Mark, I think I know what you're trying to say. It's like, okay, when I was going to school, I didn't like math, just crunching numbers to get other numbers, because you couldn't figure out where you went wrong. Whereas if you went and took a course in physics and you had to figure out the speed of a ball down an inclined plane and take into account friction, then you come up with an answer that you can take a look at and say, wow, I really blew that. It can't be moving that fast at the end of this. So, crunching numbers just to get other numbers, I think that was a factor in what deters a lot of students from math, because you really couldn't see where you were going. If you got an answer and it wasn't correct, it wasn't easy to see where you went wrong.
You can get over theoretical very quickly, and then you lose a lot of students. So that practical application of knowledge is very important. But a classic math example, if you take 2 plus 3 times 2, most people would think, okay, 2 plus 3 is 5 times 2 is 10. And if you plug it into a calculator, that's exactly what will happen. But math says you have to multiply before you add, unless there are parentheses.
So right, actually, order of operations is what we're talking about.
That's exactly what we're talking about. And when we talk, calculators don't know order of operations.
Right.
Right? The student has to know order of operations, and that's still key. So the way students learn and what they need to know, because there's so much information available on the Internet, at their fingertips, at the drop of a hat, it's not as important to have facts memorized anymore, but it's critical to be able to look at the information that's bombarding you, sort it out, prioritize it, and then figure out how you're going to use it.
Okay, that leads me into the other question that I had, which was, what tools do students need today to succeed, and what distracts or holds them back?
So obviously they need to be able to get to information, and they need to be able to sort out the value of that information and distill it down to the essence of what they're looking for. A lot of that comes from technology, and so students need to be able to be very comfortable with technology. That's not a big problem for most students, but access to technology, I think, is key. We're in an age where they expect to be connected 24/7 anywhere in the world, any time of the day or night. They expect to be able to hop on. When we had that little earthquake a while back and our Internet went down, and we almost had to shut down the school district. Our calendars didn't work. Our email didn't work. It was almost impossible to communicate to get our job done. That's just an example of how interconnected we are with information. We've really moved to an information age. If you look at where a lot of the big money is being made, especially in the lower 48, it's being made by companies like Google, like Microsoft, like Oracle. They deal in information. They sell information. They help you gather information and then use that information. So it's a whole different way of thinking, and the students of this generation need to be very good at it.
Ultimately, yes. I mean, the earthquake in the air traffic control biz was pretty much a disaster. I mean, we get all kinds of information that comes in to our system through the internet. I mean, we're connected. We process data and get our information that way. So when the earthquake hit, we have a certain amount of redundancy in that we have a few satellite-based things that as long as we've got power, those things arrive. But, you know, without it, we sort of limp along waiting for the internet to come back up.
You don't control the air traffic from this mic, though, right? There's another?
No.
Okay, all right.
But, yeah, it's kind of been a lifelong career. But getting back to your background in chemistry and physics,
sure.
As far as leading that into instruction, do you find that students work better when they get practical examples as far as, you know, problems that they're applying in math and physics versus just crunching a problem to get an answer at the end?
Absolutely. And without getting too complex, the reason calculus was invented is to explain physics, because you couldn't understand an object at rest, meaning time is zero. Using regular math, it means it's undefined. If you divide by zero, it's undefined, but we know things at rest don't disappear. So the whole idea of a math that ties with the science because one explains the other all come together, which is why our science, technology, and engineering and math, STEM project, is so key, because we realize that separately they don't mean much, but together they can mean the world. And we're doing some stuff with, example, teaching robotics to elementary school kids, just so that they can see how it applies.
Well, I sort of opened the door on that. So let's talk a little bit about the STEM program. What exactly is it for our listeners out there?
So STEM is an acronym, S-T-E-M, and S is science. T is a technology, which we've already talked about, that you we live in an era where technology in the world of communication is just so key. E is the engineering, which is kind of where we hope a lot of the people will go. I think if we're going to continue to have a strong country and a country that leads the world in a lot of areas, that engineering is a critical discipline that we need. My son is an engineer in Silicon Valley and designs computer chips that they put in cars so that when you start your car and the electricity surges all through it, that it doesn't surge to the computer and short out your computer, which would be about a $2,000 repair.
At least.
Yeah, at least, right. That's before you put it in.
Right.
And then math, which is the basis of almost all sciences, so that's kind of at the base. If you don't have that strong math background, when you get into the upper sciences, you just won't be able to understand them. And without this math and science, then the engineering and the technology that comes from that simply can't occur. We also sometimes call it STEAM, and the A that we put in there is for art, because we also feel that a balanced education and an education that doesn't just focus on science and math, but also has people understand the value of art and the beauty of art is important in having a well-rounded student and ultimately well-rounded graduate and member of the community.
All right, and that brings about another question is, how do we attract more students to science and math disciplines?
I think you make it fun. I think you make it cool. I think you make it interesting. You ask them to try to explain why things happen. I think the reason we've survived as a species is because we're interested in our environment and we observe our environment and we try to explain why things happen in our environment. The way we're wired is very much cause and effect. We want to know if we do A, what happens with B. You know, we learned that if we put our hand in hot water, it hurts, so then we don't do that again. So as human beings, we're wired to learn, we're wired to observe, and I think tapping into that in science and math education is very much the way to go. The more we learn from books when it comes to science and math, especially at an early age, as opposed to feeling and touching and doing, I think is a disservice.
All right, Mark. And that kind of brings to mind the things that stick in your brain, what you learned from. going back to high school for me, chemistry. They probably don't do this anymore, but we actually went outside with a bucket of water and dropped bits of magnesium in it to see what the reaction would be. And I don't know if you probably can't do that nowadays, but we did it, and it stuck in my mind as, oh, wow, okay, that's what happens when those bonds exchange violently in that kind of a chemical reaction.
That's a great example, and so I had to learn the hard way.
You did that too?
About that, because I did it as a demonstration. And when you do sodium and then potassium, which are right underneath each other in the periodic table, they react the same, but as you go down the periodic table, the further down you go, the more reactive the metal gets. So I started with sodium. I put a little beaker on the overhead projector, right, the old overhead
mm-hmm.
projectors,
oh, yeah.
and dropped it in, and you could see it bubble. And I was explaining how potassium reacted more violently. And I had practiced this on prep period, so I knew exactly how much potassium to put in. But again, I hadn't thought about the application of my practical knowledge. So guess what happens to water when it sits on an overhead projector for about 15 minutes? While you're explaining this,
it gets hot.
And what do you think happens when you drop in what was the perfect amount of potassium in 30 degree or 40 degree water into 90 degree water?
Well, you've already got the atoms excited.
You
so.
Do. So yeah. It blows up, and then the glass
right broke.
On, yeah, it did. Yeah, and the kids thought I had done it on purpose, and I was like the coolest teacher ever. But which kind of leads you to the idea that as you teach, you get better at it because you learn and take that experience to become more effective.
All right. Well, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Dr. Mark Miller, thank you very much. Welcome to Juneau, and I wish you all the success as new superintendent.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
This is Bird Note. That prehistoric sounding call is from a great blue heron. This tall, stately bird is commonly seen standing alone on beaches, in marshes, on docks and pilings, even on tree branches, watching, waiting. Now, from earlier this summer, the raucous sound of a colony of nesting great blue herons. Herons collect into groups for nesting, constructing their Spartan stick nests in adjoining trees. Several nests may be crammed into one tree. As many as 60 nests in a colony can create quite a frenzy. Nesting in large colonies helps protect the young from predators. But by this time of year, the adults and gangly young have left the nests to take up solitary lives along beaches, marshes, lake edges, and rivers. After all the togetherness of the nesting colonies, the herons spend the off-season by themselves, a pattern that is the reverse of many other species. During fall and winter, they defend the areas where they feed as adamantly as other birds defend their nesting territories in spring. The herons challenge and scare away intruders, including other great blue herons, by sounding this call. It may sound strange, but it's one beautiful bird. Got a photo? Share it with our listeners. Begin at our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
PM, you're listening to KTOO 104.3 in Juneau. Tonight's forecast is mostly cloudy with patchy fog late, lows in the upper 40s with light winds. Tomorrow, decreasing clouds, patchy fog in the morning with highs around 65 and light winds. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy, patchy fog again with lows in the upper 40s and light winds. And Thursday, it actually says it should be coming Sunday by the afternoon. And it's been great hosting for everybody today. I'm Ken Fix, and I will be around again next Tuesday for another edition of a Juneau Afternoon. And I'd like to remind you guys that All Things Considered will be coming up next. And let's see, what else did I have to add here? Not much. I don't think I'm going to read the translator ID anymore today. I'm going to let Diane do it. So here's Diane with our factual information on the translator IDs.
This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. We rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K201AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juneau, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
We have been ringing the alarm since the beginning of the Ebola epidemic.
But the Ebola outbreak